Welcome back to New Books in American Studies. I'm the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. Today I have with me Daniel Geary, the Mark Pigott Associate Professor in U.S. History at Trinity College Dublin. His book, Beyond Civil Rights, The Monaghan Report and Its Legacy, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press, is the topic of this show. In his detailed and illuminating reception analysis, Geary argues that Patrick Monaghan's 1965 report, The Negro Family, The Case for National Action, was neither a conservative or liberal document, but rather a conflicted one whose internal contradictions reflected the breakup of the liberal consensus and its legacy. The ambiguities of the report allowed multiple interpretations from both the left and the right and marked the emergence of neoconservatism. Conservatives used the report to rally against the liberal welfare state and promote African-American self-help. Liberals saw in the document the need to go beyond legal equality to aggressive economic intervention through training programs, job creation, and the family wage. The extensive and long debate involved issues of family structure, the source of social pathology, and the culture of poverty. African-American civil rights leaders split over the report. The Black Power representatives attacked its white sociological perspective that failed to take into account how Black people themselves saw the situation. Black feminists protested the portrayal of Black women as domineering matriarchs and the male breadwinner model. By the time of the Nixon administration, fatigue over the debates had Monaghan arguing for benign neglect rather than national action, believing in an unfolding of progress evident in the Black middle classes. After 50 years, the reverberations for the Monaghan Report continue as Americans wrestle with the relationship between race and economic inequality and the unfinished business of social equality that moves beyond civil rights. Here's my conversation with Daniel Geary. Now, let me introduce you to the author, Daniel Geary. I have the pleasure of having Dan with me today in person. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here.
Thank you for joining me in discussing your book, which is a very interesting, I think, very interesting book. It brings out many salient issues that are really still in play today, and especially in the late 20th century. So before we get into the book, tell us about yourself, your background, and how you came to write Beyond Civil Rights.
Well, let's see. I grew up in Williamsburg, Virginia, and past several years I've been teaching overseas since 2008 in Ireland at Trinity College. And this is Beyond Civil Rights, my second book. It wasn't the book I thought I was writing at the time. I thought I was writing a larger book about the history of sociological ideas in public policy. I was going to span the whole 20th century, even well, it's the late 19th century. And while researching one of those chapters was going to be on the Moynihan Report, when I got into the archives of the Library of Congress, this is maybe 2008, I found just a tremendous wealth of materials, not just detailing Moynihan's views, but the responses to him. And I realized that even though lots of people had written about this report, that there was a whole story that really hadn't been told. And that's really how I came to write it. And then I guess also thinking about the 50th anniversary coming out this year, 2015, realizing that there would be some discussion, you know, around the report and a good time to sort of assess its both its origins and its legacy.
So tell us something about Moynihan. Who was he?
Well, Moynihan, you know, he when he writes the report in 1965, I mean, so he's Irish-American or Irish-German-American, Catholic, grows up in New York City. His sort of central event of his childhood is his father, was from a pretty comfortable middle-class family until his father abandoned the family when Moynihan was a young child. And that sort of sent the family into the Great Depression, sent the family into a very precarious economic state. But he works his way out of that. Especially during World War II, he goes into the Reserve Officer Training Corps in the Navy. Navy pays for his education, his BA. Then he goes on to get a PhD at Tufts at the Fletcher School there, basic training for a political career. And was active in New York politics and is then hired into the Kennedy administration of the Department of Labor. And eventually, by the time he writes the report, he's assistant secretary of labor. But he's not, even though he did have a degree in political science, you know, he's someone who has an academic background and a political background. But interestingly, one thing he doesn't really have, we'll probably get to his writing beyond the melting pot, but one thing he doesn't really have, and he writes when he's in early 1960s, is any expertise on the issues of race.
Okay, so when he goes into writing this report, he's looking strictly at economics. Is he an economist or not?
He's a political scientist, his background. Yeah.
So what is your major argument about this report, the Monahan report, and what he did and what he was trying to do?
Well, so the Monahan report, it's officially called the Negro Family, the Case for National Action. This is a 1965 report by the Department of Labor that Monahan writes more or less on his own initiative, hoping to attract the attention of some policymakers in the Johnson administration, which he does, in fact. And I'm not sure that there's, you know, that you can say there's any single clear intention that Monahan had. I mean,
so he didn't really intend for it to be published. Did he write it as sort of a career move, like to show his superiors what he knew, what he had gathered? So.
I think it's an internal memo. As I say, you know, no one told him to write. He decided to write on his own. He had picked up, you know, certain ideas, partly from writing this book, Beyond the Melting Pot, with Nathan Glaser in 1963. I think it's very important for Monahan. That's a book about New York City ethnic and racial groups. Sort of exposes Monahan to some of the issues facing African Americans. Also, this is a period in the mid-1960s where people like Monahan, who maybe had not very much personal experience with African Americans, very little training dealing with African American issues, you know, this is the sort of the heart of the civil rights movement. You know, he realizes this is a major policy issue that the Johnson administration has, is how it's going to respond to the civil rights movement. Pass the Civil Rights Act, but, you know, there are broader issues that the civil rights movement is putting on the table in terms of full equality, especially economic equality. And Monahan thinks he's got a perspective on that that would be useful to officials in the Johnson administration.
Okay, one thing I want to focus in on first is really his ideas, he thought, and then we'll talk about the reception of the book or what became a book.
Yeah.
So he wanted to overlook race is one of the things that you talk. He wanted to really talk about class.
Yeah.
But in doing that, if he was going to talk about class, he zeroed in on black underclass and didn't seem to be, did he deal with at all in his report about the white underclass?
He doesn't. I mean, he focuses specifically on, you know, reports on the Negro family, and he sort of assumes that, he makes the assumption that white family structure is fine. It's not a problem. So, it's a curious report because on the one hand, Monahan's concerns are in some ways fundamentally about economics and class. But on the other hand, the way that he presents the report tends to racialize the issues.
So he's really kind of overlooking maybe a huge number of Americans who are in poverty who are white.
He does in the report. I think he thinks, you know, he's concerned about that elsewhere. I think he's maybe hoping to use the issue of Negro families in the context of the civil rights movement to advance more universal measures that would have benefited all Americans. But the way that he presents the data, you know, really presents it as an African-American problem.
Okay.
You know?
How does he represent really the liberal consensus position at that point?
I think, in a number of ways. I mean, one is simply, I suppose, his placement, you know, that the idea that armed with knowledge, you know, knowledge that he gathers from social scientific experts, from the government, you know, that it's up to sort of technocratic elites, really, to solve social problems. And that someone like Monahan with, you know, not a lot of experience in this issue can come along and see the right way to do things. That the federal government is able to solve these issues also as part of the liberal consensus at the time. And But I think there's a sort of broader tension or contradiction among liberals when confronted with the full issue of racial inequality. I mean, I don't think it's true, as some people have said, that these liberals are in some ways colorblind. I mean, they're aware that the Civil Rights Act is not going to bring about equality. But at the same time, the way that they believe that equality can be brought about doesn't, I think, you know, really tackle the sort of the deep structural roots of racial inequality. I mean, they're looking, you know, Moynihan's approach is to say, well, if we're going to achieve equality, then African Americans are going to have to compete on equal terms with other groups. And how are we going to sort of raise their competitiveness? So he's really focused on improving African Americans rather than, say, on improving the social structure as a whole.
Okay. Now, Moynihan really thought of these African Americans like they were just another immigrant group.
He does treat them according to that model. Yeah. So that's, I mean,
but the only problem is they had been here for 200 or 300 years. So did he know any African Americans? What was his experience with African Americans? Or were they just sort of, a white person's image of his mind about what African Americans were about? What was his knowledge of them?
I think that he didn't have a great deal of personal knowledge, you know, of African Americans. He doesn't see that really as a problem because he thinks that they can be understood in terms of broader statistics. You know, he went to school in East Harlem and certainly would have known some African Americans, but there's no evidence to suggest that he had any friends that, for example, that were African American. He talked to some African American experts on the topic, you know, some of whom had similar views to Moynihan. But really, he is viewing things, and this comes out of his book with Glaser on Beyond the Melting Pot, of the European immigrant group experience. You know, he's Irish-American. He sort of claims this as the basis of his expertise on racial issues more generally, including dealing with African-Americans. And the argument is that, European immigrant groups were able to succeed in American society because of certain strengths that they had, the ability to work together as a community, and features like strong family structures. And he's worried that African-Americans, their route to success as a group is going to have to be the same as the other European immigrant groups. But he's worried, looking at family structure, he's worried that they don't have the same characteristics that will allow them to succeed.
Now, in his report, he ends up talking about things like the buzzwords culture of poverty and social pathology, which he relates to a breakdown of an African-American family structure. What was his model that he was comparing African-American families to?
I mean, Moynihan very much quite openly supports the kind of the male breadwinner model. His ideal family is one in which the man is the principal breadwinner, in which women are focused primarily on the primary responsibilities. He's done from women working, you know, before they have young children or even afterwards. But he thinks, you know, when they're young children, the family women should be at home full time. And so that's his sort of normative family model. And in a way, you know, by saying that many African Americans fail to achieve this model, he saw this as a way, I suppose, of highlighting racial injustice, you know, how terrible it is that, you know, African American mothers have to be in the workplace.
Okay. So in a nutshell, can you tell us what this report says? Can you just sort of give us?
Sure. Yeah, so I mean, I think the thesis of the report is that what Moynihan saw as weak and, in effect, deteriorating aspects of African American family structure, reflected especially in out of wedlock births and high rates of female headed families, that this was the factor that was going to prevent African Americans from achieving equality. That, you assume that equal opportunities have been given, but unlike these European immigrants we talked about before, African Americans weren't prepared to take care of these, to take advantage of these opportunities because of this weakness in family structure, which he saw as weakening both individuals, you know, children and their capacity to develop, as well as the community as a whole.
Now, he had a He also proposed in that report, is that correct, a lot of solutions, a bunch of breadbasket of solutions, you know, including military service, job programs, guaranteed income, education. Talk about those a little bit, about what his proposals were and how did they reflect the thinking of the time?
Well, we know the report actually doesn't have any proposals in it, which caused some confusion over it. But we know about, if you read it closely, you can tell what he's advocating. And if you read his memos from the time, you can tell what he thought, what he hoped the government would do. So one thing, as you mentioned, is increased recruitment of African-American men in the military, giving them jobs, but also giving them, as Moynihan put it, discipline. He also favored public works programs like the WPA and the New Deal to provide guaranteed employment to men, so again, so they could serve as family breadwinners. He knew, however, that Johnson didn't support that, and so he never proposed that to Johnson. And in fact, that proposal or that idea that Moynihan had was always dead in the water as a policy idea because he knew it wasn't going to get support. He also supported a guaranteed annual income, replacing the existing system of welfare aid to families with dependent children with a payment to all families. And Moynihan saw this as shoring up intact families rather than making payments to single mothers, in effect.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about this culture of poverty and social pathology.
Yeah.
Did he believe that poverty caused family breakup, or did family breakup cause poverty?
I think that Moynihan was confused exactly on this issue of cause and effect. Of course, it can be true in theoretical terms that it could be both, but from a policy perspective, it made a big difference which one he was emphasizing. So, if you see weakness in family structure basically as a result of economic insecurity, of poverty, well, then you're going to wind up with solutions saying, we need to improve economic equality, we need jobs programs, we need income programs, that sort of thing. If you take it the other way around, say, as Moynihan did at times, that it's actually family structure that's creating poverty, that lends itself to people who say, well, this is an issue of values, of culture, and improvements in family values and cultural values need to come from African-Americans themselves, which is an interpretation that many put on the report. So I think the report can be read in both ways, as far as that cause and effect goes. And I don't think that Moynihan himself was very clear about which he wanted to emphasize.
Do you think that because he was writing this as an internal memo, he didn't develop his ideas as fully as he would have if he had written it as a formal book for publication? And that's, therefore, he leaves a lot of things undefined, makes a lot of statements that are just hanging there without any resolution, and that this is really what ends up really biting him biting him back.
I think that's partly it. I mean, it's a very weird document. On the other hand, it must be said that, Moynihan plays a pretty key role in making this document public. So he probably could have taken the position at a certain point, let's not release this thing to the public. I want to do it again. I want to write a different thing that we make public. He never said that. So I think that he was genuinely, had different conflicting ideas and was confused in his own mind and hadn't sorted these things out. And he's not it's a political document. Moynihan's a very smart guy for sure. He's picking ideas up from academia, but it's not a scholarly paper and it shouldn't be read as such. It probably wouldn't have, even though some of the ideas accord with what some social scientists said at the time, some of the lack of rigor or some of the use of statistics probably wouldn't have passed muster in a sort of peer-reviewed journal article.
Okay, so how did the report end up being published?
So, yes, so the report is finished in March, And it gets the attention of Johnson and of Johnson's advisors, especially people like Bill Moyers, who was his press secretary at the time. Then it actually informs the major address that Johnson makes at Howard University in June of 1965. After that point, it's probably inevitable that the report would become public because it was the basis for this address, and, you know, people in Washington knew about it. Over the summer, you know, sort of leaks come out about the report. Moynihan himself gives the report to the New York Times, although he said he did it with the White House permission. And then finally, it's sort of the Johnson administration decides we're just going to make this publicly available because it's already being talked about in the press, so let people see it. That's in August of 1965, just after the Watts uprising.
Okay, so this report gets published, and all of a sudden, wow. Yes. It's an explosion in yes. terms of the responses from across the ideological
yeah.
spectrum, from all different quarters, people having strong reactions for, against, ambivalent, people switching sides. They believe what, you know, one thing about the report when they start, and then when the controversy continues, they switch sides and go, oh, yep. no, it's not as good as I thought it was. So let's talk about that conflict, because I think that was a really interesting part of your book, all the different facets, including, you know, the African-American response, which is not monolithic.
No.
So let's talk about that response first.
Yeah, I think it's a much more, as you say, a complex issue than it's been portrayed before. I mean, I felt a little bit, you know, in trying to figure out the reactions, like, you know, those Russian dolls where you keep opening one and there's another one and then there's another one inside it, that it's a little bit like this. There's so many different layers, you know, to the reception of the report, partly because of the manner in which it's released. You know, it's out in the media first, and a lot of people hear about it through the media sort of secondhand before they can get their hands on the report. Even when the report is out, they don't have enough copies to give, and people don't necessarily know how to purchase a government report. It's not like you can get it at the bookstore. But mainly, I think, because it's just of the ambiguity of the report itself and of the historical moment in which it comes out. You know, I mean, this is a sort of a key moment. Civil Rights Act has been passed. Voting Rights Act has been passed. Watts uprising gets a lot of attention. And for a moment in the fall of 1965, it looks like Moynihan's report is the Johnson administration's approach to racial issues. And people are trying to figure out, well, if this is the report that's informing what the administration is doing, what does it mean? Does this mean that the administration is, as some people said, does this mean the administration is sort of gearing up for a new round of legislation that's going to go beyond civil rights legislation to look at economic programs that are going to especially target, especially benefit African-Americans? Or is this report a rationalization that's saying, oh, that problem is rooted in family structure. It's rooted in and the family structure is rooted in deep-seated problems going back to slavery and and discrimination and a long legacy. And there's really nothing that the government can do. That this is sort of, it's going to be up to African Americans themselves to improve their culture or improve their family values. So those are as I see it, the two competing interpretations of the report, and you get, all kinds of people, you know, coming at it from one or other perspective.
Right. So now you've got this. First, you have civil rights leaders who can kind of concur with him on this and go, yes, African Americans need to shore up their families and strengthen their communities. We need to self-help.
Yeah.
Black power movement people, on the other hand, are saying what?
Well, I mean, I think the civil rights leaders they don't have a problem with the self-help aspect of it. Some of them don't. But what they really like about the report is they think, okay, the Johnson administration is going to do something. It's going to do something more. It's going to provide, in fact, a lot of people supported self-help from different perspectives. But what they really liked is they thought, okay, well, this is a case for devoting more resources to
strengthening the family.
Yeah.
Through economic programs, they're going to strengthen the family.
That's it.
In other words, strengthening the black male head of household model.
Yeah, that's exactly
right. Okay.
But black power leaders, well, certainly they it's not the self-help that disturbs them necessarily. I mean, in fact, the Nation of Islam initially hails the report, and they say, well, Morning is just saying what Elijah Muhammad's been saying for years. You know, and of course, the Nation of Islam very much supported, you know, male-headed families. And so they liked the report from that angle. They just like other aspects of it. But what Black Power leaders like Stokely Carmichael really dislike about the report is the way that Moynihan and other privileged whites had this power to kind of define African-American social life. You know, that here's this guy who has little personal experience with African-Americans, little expertise, and he is presenting a certain image of African-American families. And, you know, so people like Carmichael say, this is not, people like Moynihan shouldn't have the power to do this. You know, it should be up to African-Americans to get to define the terms by which they're understood in the public at large.
Now, at the same time, you've got Black studies and other things coming up. So you have Black sociology that seems to be kind of encouraged by this report, but basically saying this report is based on white sociological studies with their, you know, presuppositions and their views of family life. And it doesn't really consider Black families within their own internal system of values.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about Black sociology.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, I think that's, and this is one of the sort of longer term impacts of the report that, you know, we're going, this goes on into the, you know, mid to late 70s at the very, at least, you know, where people are responding to the Moynihan report. And it very much spurred a kind of a counter movement, counter studies of African-American family and social life. There's one of the guys who was involved in trying to refute Moynihan was a guy named Robert Staples. And when I interviewed him, he said, although he completely disagreed with Moynihan's interpretation, he said, you know, Moynihan gave me the ability to say these things. I mean, he wasn't even necessarily as interested in African-American family structure per se, but he said there was such interest in publishers to get an African-American scholar could write on the issues that Moynihan had identified, that basically it opens up the space for him to criticize Moynihan. What Staples and others say, and they don't necessarily all agree, Black sociologists especially, on what the family model, what the proper family model should be. But what they say is, you know, Moynihan has judged African-American families from a white perspective. He doesn't really understand what the values of African-American families are. And that they should be judged in their own terms and in their ability to basically to survive living within a racist society.
Or even develop alternative kinship ties or ways of structuring families that are not two parents.
Well, there's some who say that too, who say, well, the nuclear family model is, you know, is deeply problematic and that there's an African-American family model that's based on, as you say, extended kinship network and ties that it may in some ways actually be superior to, you know, the nuclear family norm.
Yeah, because there's more people involved, for instance, in a child. It's not just the parent, the two parents. It's the aunt, the grandmother, the uncle, all these people that are involved. So it's not just two people by themselves, nuclear family.
Yeah, and it's based more on you know, cooperative ties rather than on competition. Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, obviously some of those portrayals are
romanticized.
Yeah, quite romantic. You know,
yeah, quite romantic, yes.
But, yeah.
So let's look at the Black feminists. They responded to this too.
Yeah.
What was their response to the report?
Well, I think it's a really key text for Black feminists. I think Black feminists are too often left out of the histories about the Moynihan report, so I wanted to include them because I think they really are the report's most thoroughgoing and in some ways significant critics because, you know, they criticize it from all angles. You know, both in terms of its portrayal of African-American life, picking up the sort of the critique of the Black sociology movement, but also criticizing its gender ideology and the way that it portrays African-American women as matriarchs. That's the term that Moynihan used.
As a negative, in a negative term.
In a negative term, yeah.
Right.
I mean, Moynihan does, you know, Moynihan does say, well, they're forced to be matriarchs. It's not their choice. If they, if, you know, they love to be, you know, housewives, you know, suburban middle-class whites, if they had the economic possibility. But he clearly sees it as a negative.
And so, he sees strong women as a negative.
Yes, he sees that as a negative.
And sort of seeing it as a positive role in a community.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. And so, well, black feminists have a couple different lines of critique of this, actually. Some say, what are you talking about? African-American women do not have a great deal of power in their community. You know, they face a great deal of sexism from African-American men, and they're not empowered in any way. Others say, well, actually, Moynihan is not right about matriarchal, but he's right that there is more balanced power relations among men and women and African American families. So this is a good thing. We should be celebrating this. It's the, you know, it's a patriarchal model that's the one that's messed up. But I think for black feminists, the Moynihan Report is such an important symbol because there were many African American radicals, male radicals or black power radicals who were strongly critical of Moynihan, but still supported patriarchal families, you know, would talk about the castration of African-American men and the need to build African-American men as powerful figures, including in their families. And black feminists say, look, what you're saying, it's what Moynihan's saying. And they all hate Moynihan. So by sort of making that point, like you're just agreeing with Moynihan, it's a very powerful argument that they can make against them. Yeah.
There's also the issue of the family wage. Is there not, when you're talking about African-American women are in the workforce, they're working, and Moynihan's coming in and saying, we want to make it where the woman can stay home and the man's going to support the wife. But feminists are going to say, wait a minute, we're workers too.
Yeah, sure.
And you're going to overlook the economic part. You're going to favor men economically.
Well, Moynihan specifically favors taking jobs away from African American women and giving them to African American men. I mean, he does. It's not in the report, although it follows the logic, but you know, but he supports that. And some African American feminists, like Pauli Murray, they recognize that, and she's on it already in 1965, and they say, you know, this is crazy. I mean, African American families rely on women's income. There's nothing wrong with women working, and instead of trying to, you know, improve opportunities just for African American men, maybe we could try to improve the sort of the wages and working conditions of African American women who are actually already supporting their families. So
now the thing Moynihan was concerned about with black families, such as single parenting, cohabitation, working women, are all things that since then have become mainstream. It's very interesting because now it's really the mainstream of the middle.
It is. I mean, it's one of the things that, to me, when people talk about the Moynihan Report in contemporary, you know, culture, mm-hmm. that there's a kind of disconnect that, you know, that the family model that Moynihan supported is no longer the norm. And you can't really understand, his report doesn't really make sense at all if you don't support the sort of the male breadwinner norm. Now, of course, there are some conservatives who harken back to the Moynihan Report and say, and they like that aspect of it. You know, they're quite open about one of the reasons why they like the report is these sort of patriarchal ideals. But there are a lot of people, you know, liberals and other sort of centrist types who support the Moynihan Report and hail it as prophetic, but they kind of fail to grapple with, you know, with its sort of gender ideology. And they fail to say whether, you know, do they agree with Moynihan that we should go back to this, or how can this report work if you discard that?
Yeah, because you still hear a lot of people talking about the family today, pundits, political pundits, talk about it like Moynihan, you know, just this two people with two kids in the suburbs with jobs, and which is a very, very small minority now.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that's true. It's not, it's very, if you look at the sociologist, William Joyce Wilson, the African-American sociologist, he really is a liberal, and he's done a lot to revive the report in liberal circles, you know, but he he clearly supports this core male Bremer idea, but he doesn't own it in the way that Moynihan does. I think he says in his book, The Truly Disadvantaged, he says, well, among whites, if there's a divorce, that's a good thing because it's allowing women to escape a bad marriage. But it's like a terrible catastrophe for African Americans. So it doesn't even, like, it doesn't add up, I guess.
Yeah, does it come to the economic argument that divorce is expensive and the only people who can get a divorce and not suffer, you know, terrible consequences are people who have are affluent? Is there something in that? It's expensive to get a divorce.
It's true, yeah.
And to have children when there's divorced parents. So that maybe the more affluent you are, the easier it is to do.
Yeah, I think there's part of that. I suppose it's also, a reason that would explain lower marriage rates among, you know, lower class Americans as well. The expense of, well, getting married, but then
and getting divorced.
Yeah, and getting divorced. So yeah, and then which also leads you to, I'm not a sociologist who studies African American families, but I wouldn't share the sort of romantic view that exists in the 1960s and 1970s. But I also don't think you can just take this a statistic like, these are the marriage rates and assume that explains what the family structure actually is, because it could be that you have intact families, or you could have family, that they're just not, man and woman are together, they're just not married,
right.
Or you could have a case where they're not married, but, there's still a man involved,
Right.
I think it's very problematic to do what Moynihan did and say, and as a lot of commentators to do today say, well, this percentage, single parent families, this means this,
Right. So now, how much do you think that this report influenced the conversation in the 1980s and 70s about, 1980s and 90s about family values and all this that we heard on the right?
Yeah, I mean, the conservatives picked up the report early on, but in the 80s and 90s,
applied it no longer just to African-American families. They're applying it to the whole of society.
And they apply it to the whole society, and they say this is, there's the broader problem of family values. And the report has a very effective, it's very effective for conservatives in a number of ways, but I mean, I guess the main way is it explains inequality in a way that lets Americans off the hook for it. Because even though, conservatives are sort of colorblind, I mean, nobody, would say that there's racial equality in the United States today. It's obvious, there are obvious disparities between whites and African Americans. So you need an explanation for that. It is a broader class issue, but often we talk about class issues in terms of African-Americans. And so conservatives say, well, the reason why there's inequality is it's family, it's family values. It's not history of racism. It's not continuing existing structural racism, but it's an issue of family values. And therefore it's sort of up to African-Americans to solve themselves. So it's a nice compliment in a way, to colorblind ideology, and it's a convenient rationalization for inequality, not just racial inequality, but class inequality as well, because I think that's what they're really concerned with, explaining why some people are, poor and some people are rich.
Now, how did Moynihan respond to all this criticism? I mean, he gets a tidal wave. Now, it brings him a lot of publicity and attention, and he's lecturing, and he's running around talking to the media,
yep.
And he's really, giving it all he's got. What happens to him with this?
I mean, it launches his career, really, in an important way. I mean, no doubt he was, became a kind of lightning rod for a lot of criticism, where, like, take Black feminists, there, a lot of the criticism Moynihan were, in my mind, valid, but you know, they're singling him out when they could be talking about a lot of people. You know, Moynihan's getting the...
It becomes a symbol.
Yeah, that's right. Moynihan's getting the flack when really he was expressing the views that, you know, most of the, you know, men of his time and place had. You know, and he was certainly hurt by that criticism, some of which was intemperate and unfair. A lot of it, which was well-reasoned and valid. But, you know, there's no doubt that this is what Thayer launches his career. I mean, he becomes a professor at Harvard, director of a Center on Urban Studies, basically based on his expertise that this report had established.
Which is an awful narrow basis to get for him to get what he the positions that he had.
It did, yeah.
It seemed rather excessive.
Yeah, I mean, you take a guy, I mean, I talk about a book, there's a guy, St. Clair Drake, who's a very, fantastic African-American scholar, who had co-wrote Black Metropolis, been around for a long time, and he is just outraged that Moynihan calls him an instant expert, you know, on the topic, whereas Drake is, eventually he's hired at Stanford in the 1970s, but you know, in the mid-60s when, you know, Harvard or the sort of elites or the press, when they're looking for someone who can try to explain what's going on in African-American neighborhoods, you know, why there's rioting, you know, why inequality persists, you know, Moynihan's the guy they turn to. So, it says a lot, I think, about the, you know.
The Washington Network?
Yeah.
He's an insider.
He is, yeah, yeah.
Now, your book is situated in such a very critical point between the breakup of the liberal consensus and the emergence of neoconservatism.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where you've got it right there. And that's a sweet spot, I think, of the book, placing him in the report right there in that place. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think that in my view, there was no liberal consensus as such. Now, people like Moynihan believed in it. And there were a number of things that that liberals agreed on. But there were also a lot of cracks. But those cracks, you really start to see them in the mid to late 60s as liberals fail to be able to deal with, you know, a number of situations, the top two being, you know, the Vietnam War. Continued racial inequalities reflected in rioting. And that produces a variety of reactions among liberals, some of whom sort of turn left and others who back off and sort of pick up on some of the more conservative aspects that were already there among post-war liberals. And Moynihan is one of the latter. He's a neoconservative, meaning he was in his initial used neoconservatives in the late 60s were post-war liberals who started to say, we need to be moving rightward. We need to make alliances with conservatives, and we need to recognize that there's certain things that government can't do, that there's kind of ambitious social engineering, well, in many cases, you know, isn't going to work. And so Moynihan's a key articulator of those.
Almost like they're still liberal economically and socially, but there's this cultural conservatism that
yes.
they take up.
That's right. That too. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to change the subject a little bit. You had talked earlier about Moynihan. One of his solutions was providing opportunities for more African Americans into the military so they can get training and also lowering the standards. And giving them some, for the ones who had deficient educations, getting them up to standard so that they could be in the military and learn and become men. And it was this very masculinist sort of viewpoint,
Absolutely. Which is
interesting that he's saying this. And then, you know, by 65, we've got the escalation, 66, the escalation of the Vietnam War. So you have a lot more African Americans going to war and dying, which is just really a tragic sort of moment there because he's trying to help.
Yeah, he sees himself as helping, but yeah, obviously the way that he helps is, you know, and more is, I guess, points to another feature that often people often talk about, the FBM part of the report, but it quite clearly is, you know, embedded in the sort of liberal embrace of the Cold War and the kind of the American post-war imperial project. You know, or Moynihan, he had been in the military itself, but it had been a route for social advancement for him, and he thought this would be true for others. He wasn't really a big supporter of the Vietnam War itself, although he wasn't an outspoken critic of it either, but he, you know, still saw this as a route to advancement. And this is one of the things that earned him, we talked about the Nation of Islam before, they kind of like his family ideology, but they really hate that suggestion. And there's Louis Farrakhan goes to do a long interview with Moynihan, and they print it like in five parts in Muhammad Speaks, the Nation of Islam paper. And one of the interviews, you know, Moynihan says something like this: well, you know, we need more African-American men in the military, we'll give them jobs and job skills. And they illustrated this with, it's basically like a picture of death with a scythe. And then it's an African-American soldier, buried Vietnamese in a mass grave. So it's not at all subtle. So, you know, they really call Moynihan to task for saying, you think that improved, you know, job opportunities are, you know, going and murdering, you know, Vietnamese peasants and, you know, putting us at risk.
It's kind of interesting because, you know, in World War II, African Americans were joining the military because they wanted to show that they were patriotic, and they felt like if I show my patriotism by joining the military, I will show that I am a full-fledged, worthy citizen of the United States and have all the rights and responsibilities, yeah, until they come back and they're denied so many of their civil rights after they fought the war. But now he's telling them, go to the military. The military is going to make you into a man. And what's going to happen is a lot of African-American men are going to fight the Vietnam War and die.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, it's really ironic and tragic.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously not something that Moynihan had predicted, you know, when he wrote Reuters report. You know, but on the other hand, as I said, it must be said, he's been in this, you know, he's very much part of this, you know, Cold War framework that produces a Vietnam, you know, so he's responsible for it, you know, in that sense.
Now, after they have this very lively debate, it eventually kind of runs out of steam, and Moynihan ends up proposing a sort of benign neglect.
Yeah.
Or that's the term. It ends up in something he writes.
So this is a memo he writes to Richard Nixon when he's in the – Richard Nixon makes him his kind of one of his major domestic advisors because, you know, Moynihan post-reported established himself as a sort of expert on – specifically on, you know, African-Americans and on explanations for the growth of rioting in urban areas. And so Moynihan writes a memo to Nixon that's later leaked, much like the report, in which he says to Nixon, we need a period of benign neglect of discussing race, that basically things had gotten, were too overheated on both sides, and that we should just stop talking about race and try to make quiet progress. Now, clearly, this, I think, was partly rooted in Moynihan's understanding of his own personal experience in the Moynihan report, where he thought, you know, my goodness, you know, like you try to discuss this issue, you know, you just get it from all sides. You know, but when this is leaked, especially in the context of, you know, Nixon's civil rights policies and his backtracking on, you know, a number of civil rights measures, and the federal government is really, by this point, it had really stepped, you know, there was maybe a moment in the mid-60s where people were saying, well, the federal government can really have some kind of massive investment in urban areas that would especially benefit African Americans. And that's not on the table in 1970. So a lot of people, when they see this memo, say, well, this is basically a rationalization for the federal government stepping back, you know, saying benign neglect. And Moynihan wasn't saying, you know, the government should neglect African Americans. He was saying we should neglect the discussion of it. But as his critics rightly pointed out, I mean, how are you going to, if you can't discuss the issue, how can you really deal with it?
And actually, benign neglect is actually what happened in the 80s and 70s, 80s and 90s. And now we've got, you know, a racial mess. in this country.
Yeah.
And it's almost like we've got all these unresolved issues that never got addressed, never got finished, are now coming back.
It does. I mean, the phrase accurately reflects, you know, the federal government policy in many ways, too. So,
what do you think your book's going to be useful? Where do you want it to fit in the historiography of the 20th century? Where do you think it fits?
I think that it fits in a number of places. One is we talked about before, sort of post-war liberalism, you know, and the history of post-war liberalism and challenges to it and its own internal tensions and contradictions. One obviously having to do with history of discussions of racial inequality, you know, since 1965, but also broader issues of inequality as well, as we talked about gender inequality, class inequality. So I think it really, I hope the book can tell us about some of the kind of roots of the political culture of our own time, as well as some of the, I suppose, the genuine differences between, you know, the political and intellectual culture of the late 1960s, early 1970s, and in our own.
The connections. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of, in this report and Moynihan's for career, there's a lot of points that really you see later in the 20th century, you still see them today, lots of things besides race, you know, economics, gender, like you're saying, all these things.
Sure, yeah.
So it's like he represents the conflict probably of the late 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, my first book was a biography of C. Wright Mills, and I said when I wrote my second book, I said, I don't want to do a biography, you know, but I kind of did. I mean, it's a biography of a document, of the report, and this report was, connected to all these different things, and I think when you're writing something like a biography or something like this study, you know, you have to go with the history of that document, but with the person. But you're looking, you know, if you, at least if coming at it from my angle, you're trying to explain these broader, you know, forces. So it's, that's really what I'm after. And I don't think you can pinpoint it as a single theme for that reason.
Right. Yeah. And it seems to me when I was reading it, that it kind of unleashed a lot of things that were already there. A lot of the conflicts that were already there, a lot of ideas that people were already thinking about. He just said it, the report sort of opened up the floodgates for people to come out and say, yeah, okay, this is what's going on.
Absolutely, yeah.
It was a catalyst for a lot of different debates. Right. He didn't really create the problems. He just sort of brought them to focus. And and usually I think it's what happens a lot in history. You know, we move on. We have all these issues until something happens or some event that kind of brings everything up to the surface. Well, you have been very generous with your time. I have one question for you. What are you working on now?
Well, a couple of different things. One is a project about the concept of integration, meaning racial integration. And, you know, where does that concept come from? What did it mean? What did it mean to different people? Mm-hmm. And how does it get discredited? So it'd be looking at exploring some of the issues with the book and the sort of the civil rights era, but from the perspective of this, you know, I think that historians today too often dismiss the language of integration because they say, well, integrationist is not really an adequate label to describe civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King. And I agree with that point, but people use that term at the time. So why were they using it? What did they mean? And I think it's one of these terms that was used by different people to mean different things.
And there's also desegregation, integration.
Yes, integration.
Desegregation,
yeah.
What's the difference?
I mean, before integration, people talked about assimilation,
yeah.
Yeah, and what's replaced integration now that people won't talk about that? But I do think it's, there was a moment certainly in the civil rights era, but also before and since when people, you know, what did they mean? What did they think an integrated society was like? You know, what was their vision of the future, I suppose? And what were the different visions of the future?
Yeah, that bring into the whole issue of the American melting pot. Is there a melting pot? What is the melting pot? And what does it look like? What does it taste like?
Yeah. I think that, and it fits up with that as well. I mean, you know, ideas about how people understood immigration and the melting pot, because, you know, if you don't have a melting pot, then how can you have integration? Or what would integration look like if you don't have a homogenous society in the first place? So, you know, I think there's a lot of things that could be explored from that. And I think we don't really know, you know, just the basic history of that term and who started to use it. When did they start to use it? Who picked it up? What were they picking up? I mean, I think we have a sense of who discredited that concept.
And probably if you ask people, how do you define it? You would get a lot of different definitions.
You get a lot of different answers.
Yes.
So it's quite an early stage, but I'm interested in exploring that. It's maybe in a next book.
Thank you, Dan.
My pleasure.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in American Studies. It would be a pleasure to hear from you. Drop me a line at newbooks.americanstudies@gmail.com. This is your host, Lillian Barger.